Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the Lunatics Radio Hour podcast. My name is Abby Branker. I'm here with Alan Kudan.
Hello.
And today we have two stories for you, continuing the theme of one of our favorite Universal monsters, two stories about mummies.
Mummies, that's right.
About mummies, yes.
We like mummies. I didn't expect to like mummies, but I do.
But you love the mummy, so why wouldn't you?
So, I mean, yes, I do love Brendan Fraser's The Mummy. As an abstract, though, The Mummy is kind of a lame monster. But I want to, again, as the abstract of just like the guy who walks around in bandages, kind of lame.
Okay.
But anytime you get some kind of like undead monarch, you can like make that into a mummy. And I think that's pretty cool. It's the mindless mummy that walks around that's like pretty darn boring. It's when he gets all highbrow that I get interested.
Yeah, I mean, that's something we definitely talked about with Bob on the history of mummification. And I think in the pop culture, the mummy pop culture episode, because when we're the point of you know, this podcast, right, is to trace these common horror tropes back to their origins. And so I think that's totally right. Like when you look at, of course, the origins of mummies, there's so many different ways that humans have been mummified and many different reasons. But if we're talking about Egyptian mummies, which I think is broadly often what we see in horror, or at least in the Universal films, again, looking at actual human history, there's such a ritual and meaning behind it. And it's meant for the pharaohs and the kings and, you know, and the important people a lot of the time. And then when you look at some of the works that Bob brought up in some of the early films, to your point, it's less so like guy walking around in bandages and more so like master plotter, right? Like the original mummy film from Universal is not a guy in bandages at all. It's a super smart manipulative villain. And that's something that I think gets lost when you think about some of the other films.
Which I guess is counterintuitive because I didn't really like the early mummy movies.
Yeah. But
however, so we're making a new abstract.
Okay.
Where the cool mummy is now a guy from the past, resurrected. His flesh is still not quite right, you know, but he's like an ancient monarch and he's also a high intelligence magic user.
High intelligence magic user.
Yeah, highbrow, but evil.
Right.
And uses magic.
Right. He's like a bat, like an evil magician.
An evil magician. That's right. We got to do a whole episode on evil magicians.
Right.
Is that a thing?
Sure. We have Job from Arrested Development.
He's not evil.
Yeah. He's not like amazing.
I'd say he's true neutral. Chaotic, no, chaotic neutral.
Okay, sure, sure.
He's always just out for himself, but he's, you know, he's not inherently malicious.
True. He's sort of like bumbling, I suppose.
Yeah. Very chaotic. I'm really curious what kind of stories we're going to have today.
Well, I can preview them for you.
Well, I mean, I'm just going to wildly speculate.
Okay.
I'm assuming they're going to take place in present day.
Okay. Do you want me to respond to your assumptions?
You can, I'm up to you. You can neither confirm nor deny, or you can do it literally whatever you want. I can't control you.
Yeah. I will say they're both modern takes for sure.
And I think that's key.
To the success of a mummy story?
To the success of a mummy story.
Well, I think it's sort of key to the success of, I don't know, not being, I don't know, like super problematic perhaps.
I was about to say like, because again, the juxtapose is a man from the past coming to the future or coming to the present. And if the present takes place in the past,
like Futurama,
there's a few layers on that it's gonna have to unpack.
Okay.
But you know, like it's tough when you have the ancient guy seeing the world of tomorrow and it's like 1700s. But then again, a mummy coming into the Revolutionary War sounds really freaking cool. I would watch the hell out of that movie.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, just imagine you got Imhotep doing his giant sand thing against the Redcoats. Game over, Redcoats.
That's true. That's a good point.
Those lobster backs are going home.
Like a time-traveling evil magician mummy.
Yes. Time-traveling evil magician mummy.
Somebody...
on board.
Somebody optioned this from us.
Can you imagine somebody that just like travels through time simply by mummifying themselves? I guess you're only going in one direction.
Right.
But that's pretty cool.
It's very cool.
It's
yeah.
Like, it's like Futurama when Fry freezes himself, but in this case, he just gets all dehydrated.
Right. Yeah. So why don't we jump in? So yeah, we have two stories for you today. One written by me and another written by Derek Hutchins, whose work has been featured on the podcast quite a few times. And we also have two excellent narrators this week. And I'm so thrilled with both of these stories and how they turned out. Derek's story is very, very epic. So we're going to start with mine because it's more, is a little bit shorter. And then Derek's will kind of be the headliner. But the narrators really pulled out all the stops this week and I'm over the moon.
All right, let's see what you got. Opener band, Abby.
Okay, so the first story I wrote, I will give my perspective after we play it, but it's read for us by first-time Lunatics narrator Tessa McKnight. She does an amazing job. I'm so honored. She brings the story to life in a way that, as a writer, it was really fun to see. I had a lot of fun with this, with the sort of world of this story, so we'll see what everybody thinks. But yeah, I don't want to say any more than that. So shall we roll the tape?
Here we go.
Here we go.
The Initiation. Written by Abby Breaker. Read by Tessa McKnight.
She was nervous. Of course she was. You would have been too. It was her first semester, not only away from her small-town family and friends, but her first semester at a prestigious, renowned Ivy League university where all of the other students seemed to have sports cars and watches that cost more than her family's rent. She'd felt out of place ever since she stepped out of her mum's sedan a month ago. But in the present moment, Bobby stood in front of a mausoleum which was part of the campus historic cemetery. Her blindfold had just been removed, and the full moon did a poor job illuminating the scene through the thick tangle of tree branches overhead. Bobby had suspected, from the leaves crunching beneath her feet, that they had trekked towards the forest surrounding the school. She hadn't known there was a graveyard tucked away between the trees. She tried to look around, but her captor still had their hand pressing firmly against her skull, forcing her to look forward. But she could see from the corner of her eyes that there were at least five other student prisoners. Through the darkness ahead, someone was approaching. Bobby could hear the crunch of the leaves before she could make out the figure. The advancing student slowly, dramatically, walked up the two stairs of the tomb and turned to face the group of captives and abductors. Bobby assumed this was the leader. The leader wore a black, somehow form-fitting robe. A hood covered her hair and a very antique, almost dirty mask covered most of her face. The person standing behind Bobby pressed their foot sharply behind her knee, forcing her to the ground. Bobby dropped awkwardly and could hear the surrounding students doing the same. The leader spoke. "Well, congratulations are in order. You are the chosen five." A nervous murmur echoed from Bobby's left and right. She didn't know what the hell that meant. The leader went on. "Dating back to 1713, every fall semester a chosen group of women gather, protect what is sacred to this university, and bestow the honour on the cream of the crop of the incoming freshmen." More murmuring. Bobby had already concluded that this was some sort of secret society initiation, but was completely confused as to why she would be standing here. She stuck out like a sore thumb from the rest of the students in her year. The leader continued. "As it is the highest possible honour for you to be standing here at all, you will now need to prove your loyalty." The guards holding on to each freshman erupted into a cacophony of hissing. It made Bobby jump. The society must have centred around some sort of snake theme. Though she was a history nerd, Bobby hadn't read up on the school's fraternities, sororities, or societies. She didn't have much interest or much hope that she'd ever be part of them. Now her interest was piqued. But she was wary of the hazing and being totally blind to whoever this group was. She was sceptical that she'd be aligned with the values and sacred causes of any established club at a school like this. Her brain toggled between judgment and the appeal of having friends to eat lunch with. The leader now turned towards the door to the mausoleum and pulled out a large, very old-looking brass key. The handle of the key was shaped like a snake. Bingo, Bobby thought. Snake-themed club. She was fine with that. The doors were opened to reveal an orange glow from within. A musty smell filled Bobby's nose. She was pushed forward and stumbled clumsily towards the marble entrance. Bobby gasped and heard a few other voices do so as well. There must have been 1,000 candles flickering inside. In the centre of the floor of the tomb was a gold and gemstone mosaic snake. It glittered so brightly against the dusty floor that Bobby thought it must be made of real rubies and emeralds. The leader took her place at the snake's tail, and the others created a full circle around the figure. The door was closed. Bobby looked around the circle. 6 students in pyjamas, 15 in robes and masks. The freshman's eyes darted anxiously around the room, taking it all in. "Ah," the leader said, "it is only in this circle, around Mother Snake, that we will ever talk freely, that we will ever acknowledge this calling, that we will ever talk of this group. Do you understand?" The new freshman nervously nodded. The others hissed. The leader went on. "It is only within these walls that we drop our masks, that we perform our rituals. Do you understand?" More nods and hisses. "And we do not discuss meeting times outside of these walls. If it is midnight on a full moon, you are expected to be here. If you are not, you are presumed dead. Do you understand?" They understood. But Bobby thought it was rather bold of them to expect her to dedicate so much time to this snake society without ever bothering to ask her if she wanted to be in this snake society. But she nodded along with the others. "Upper guard, remove your covers." The 15 students in robes threw back their hoods and untied their masks. Bobby looked around the room. She didn't seem to recognise any of them except for the leader. She tried to rack her brain. Maybe she was from her chemistry class? She wasn't sure. The leader's long, dark hair and piercing eyes were familiar. She was the type of person you'd remember even if you walked by her only once. She was striking. The leader nodded to one of the upperclassmen near the door, and the red-headed girl nodded back before locking them in with an identical snake key. 2 of the others started to pull out what looked like leather straps. There was an uncomfortable rustle among the freshmen. "What is about to happen is the ultimate bonding ritual," the leader spoke as the other students readied the room for something. "There is no turning back from this point. Your lives are about to change forever in the most meaningful way, a tradition that has passed down to every class for 300 years. 300 sacrifices." The leader brushed back her long dark hair. "As I said, each year we admit 5 new members, but, oh, well, look at that. Somehow there are 6 freshmen sitting before me." The girls looked around the room at each other, counting. Nervous eyes shifted left and right. They started to size each other up. 5 of you will join our prestigious ranks. You will keep the secrets of this group and you will be greatly rewarded. Gifted with opportunities, access and a sisterhood like no other. Long after you graduate, you will be protected. But such a great life comes with a cost. And you will pay your dues tonight. There is one of you who is, no doubt, utterly confused, unsure what this group is and how you ended up here. I dare say, probably confused to how you ended up at this school in the first place, given your painfully humble upbringing. No understanding of high society, no appreciation for the lifestyle or the divine history of this institution. A girl who has been quieter than most in her shoes usually are. Probably bizarrely hopeful that she was noticed and chosen. And she was. But not for the role she thought. Bobby could hear her own heart thudding in her ears. Whatever bullshit hazing ritual was about to unfold, she didn't want to be part of it. She knew she was the target. Of course she was. She had no place here. Bobby knew it would be fruitless, but she still tried to leave. Immediately, four sets of cold hands grabbed her limbs and forced her to the ground. The back of her head hit the hard marble floor. Pain shot through her body. Bobby started to scream. The leader raised her voice. There is no point. No one can hear you. The leader bent over Bobby as the others held her down. She touched a finger to Bobby's lips. Shame you won't be staying long. Freshman, this is your moment. Act now or join our sacrifice here. There are no other options. Within seconds, Bobby could feel hands at work all down her body, removing her clothing, cutting it off, binding her with leathery straps, wrapping her with rough fabric. Someone shoved a gag into her mouth. Bobby tried to strain against them, to scream for help, but it was impossible. You will join the hundreds of others who have given their lives to unite this coven. The wraps around Bobby were totally restricting her movement now. Soft, shaking hands were wrapping her face, forcing the gag deeper into her throat. Bobby tried to cough, but nothing happened. She was immobile, inside and out. Finally, her vision was taken from her. The pressure from the hands along her body started to fade away. All she could hear was hissing, echoing and reverberating off of every corner of the chamber. And then a whisper, very close to her ear. We'll be back on the next full moon, but don't worry. You'll be dead long before that. The hissing turned into a cackling. A rush of heat met Bobby's bound body. Her head pounded, her throat ached, and now she could feel the moisture leaving her mouth. Noises faded away. Bobby could tell the others had left the tomb. The heavy door was locked. She was left in silence, darkness, and pain. She hoped the leader was right. She hoped she didn't even last the night. Death would be better than this hell.
Okay, you cheated.
I cheated.
You cheated.
What does that mean?
You took a story that was very good.
Okay.
And then you gave it to someone with an amazing British narration voice.
And that's me cheating.
That's cheating. You're instant success. New York Times bestseller.
Who am I cheating?
You're stacking the deck for success.
Yeah.
It was too good.
Well, thank you. I mean, I think Tessa did such a good job. I was just so blown away when I heard the file come through, and I'm thrilled. I just love her voice so much.
She sounds so wonderful.
Yeah.
Too wonderful. This I'm trying to defend all the other people on this podcast that didn't get their story narrated with such a wonderful British voice.
I know. Tessa does a great job.
She could read us the phone book.
Oh, absolutely. I would be thrilled.
The phone book? Is that... We'd have to find a phone book.
Oh, sure. Well, what about a dictionary?
We have to find a dictionary.
Well, we could print one from the internet.
We can print... we can print a dictionary from the internet.
Yeah, no problem
what
there.
What books do we have?
Oh my God, are you kidding? We have so many books.
Okay, what non-occult books do we have?
Well, we have several occult dictionaries and demonology encyclopedias.
Which non-occult books?
There's got to be some.
There's
surely some.
Sure. All right, we'll circle back later.
We'll circle back. But Tessa did an amazing job. I hope she will agree to read some more stories for us in the future. But what did you think of the story itself?
Listen, I hope she didn't take my lobster back comments personally.
I hope so too. Don't scare her away.
However, this story is, like I said,
I hope nobody, for my own mental health, takes anything that Alan says seriously, because I spend so much of my week every week editing out things that Alan says, and I'm afraid people will take seriously. So if it's made it in, then I'm hoping that it's mild enough that it won't be offensive to a major group of people.
Do the British still get offended by revolutionary slurs?
I don't know. I don't know if they ever did.
The story itself was very good. There was some very interesting things that I'd never considered.
Hmm.
So you have a woman that gets mummified.
Bobby.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a woman, right?
Correct.
Yeah. Pronouns she, her.
Correct.
And as soon as you described the heat and the moisture leaving her mouth, I was like, that's terrible.
Hmm.
The act of your body dehydrating in real time is horrific. Absolutely horrific. You just triggered like one of my biggest fears.
Well, this is a horror podcast after all.
It is. And, you know, it's not easy to scare me. I'm pretty...
I know how to scare
pretty
you.
Pretty robust.
Vivisection.
Stop it. Come on. That was
cannibalism.
Low blow.
It's good to know now, like, what actually think one of the benefits of this podcast is learning what your triggers are for my own use.
Yeah. Vivisection, cannibalism, commitment. you're finding all the ways to really get me.
Yeah. Totally. But yeah, I really enjoyed the story. I love writing or just even reading stories that take place on like college campuses.
Is this why? Why is that?
I don't know. I think there's some sort of like dreaminess, I suppose, and I'm sure very like elitism, but some like dreaminess to like fall at school. And there's just so many classic novels that take place in those settings that it's kind of fun to turn that on its head and call out like, you know, the secret societies that are like super toxic, and obviously they're not all murdering people, but it's kind of like a fun setting, I suppose, to try to exaggerate a little bit and play with.
I think it's also just setting people up to do weird things.
Yeah, like in what other world does that make sense? But in a secret society, cool, you know?
Right, you can't have just a whole bunch of adults. Where, like, what are they going to do? Work their 9-to-5s, get a babysitter for the kids, and then go hang out with the cult? No.
Maybe.
I mean, sure, there's those people out there, but that requires a lot of prep. This is, you're just sitting around the quad. You see some people in their cultist robes.
Uh-huh.
You whisper over to Brittany, aren't those guys from 4A?
People don't walk around in their cultist robes through the quad.
And then they go over and they're just like, hey, what are you guys doing? And they're like, they know. And then they're in the cult.
Okay, that's what Alan, that's the
that's what college is like.
Secret sorority story written by Alan. Was that what college was like for you?
That was exactly what college was
like. You didn't even have a quad.
No.
You went to school in the city.
I did.
I had a quad. I had several quads. A good quad.
You still got some great quads.
Thank you. So yeah, amazing narration by Tessa. And I hope you enjoyed it. I actually like really liked the world so much that I might do some more in it.
Yeah.
You know, some more stories for it. But yeah, we'll see what happens there. Before we jump into the absolutely epic tale that we have for you next, I just want to put this out into the universe again.
We have new merch.
We do. We do have new merch. You can check that out at the link in all of our podcast episodes or go to lunaticsproject.com. But that is actually not what I was going to say. I was just going to remind any writers that we have listening that we have kind of a system in place now where I will send emails with upcoming podcast themes so that if you want to either submit a short story that you happen to already have on that theme, or it could be a radio drama, a play, it could be a poem, it doesn't have to necessarily be a story. Or if you want to write something fresh, I try to give some ample notice. I'm not always perfect with it, but we would love to feature your work on the podcast. So if you reach out to me on any of our social channels, I can get your email added to that mailing list that we have where we communicate the upcoming topics. But again, any writers listening, we would love to add you to the mailing list. We would love to feature your work. Reach out to me on Instagram at the Lunatics Project or wherever you follow us, Twitter, anywhere, TikTok, YouTube, and I will get you added to our list. You can also email us at filmsaboutlunatics, which could be a faster way. But yeah. So without further ado, this mummy story from Derek has been in the works for a really long time. Derek submitted it many moons ago. This topic kind of got pushed back a little bit. And it's just, again, such a wild ride. It's narrated for us by Bob Don, who was featured on all of the mummy episodes. So it felt very fitting that he would be included. You can follow Derek. I'm going to say it now. You can follow Derek on Twitter or Instagram at Derek M. Hutchins. He also has a book, a collection of short horror stories that we are huge fans of.
Yes, we are.
It's called The Undertaker and Other Macabre Tales. You can find it on Amazon, I believe, but definitely follow him on social to kind of get the latest with what he's working on. But we featured Derek before. We will definitely feature him again. We absolutely love his writing. And this just feels like such an epic and, you know, a great way to kind of round out this mummy series. Shall we roll the tape?
Here we go.
Here we go.
The Spectacle at Vanderburgh Manor. Written by Derek Hutchins. Read by Bob Dawn.
Scar's old pickup jolted wildly as it careened down a winding and forested hill at illegal speeds, causing Cliff to throw his arms up to keep from being hurled across the back seat.
Watch it!
Scar only snickered. The truck's bolts groaned as it began to drag itself up another steep incline. The Connecticut woods were full of them. Besides Scar in the passenger seat was Cliff's older sister, Willow, two dark braids cascading from underneath her bandana like theatrical tassels. She turned around to face him, her undecorated face simultaneously bearing signs of disappointment and amusement.
Shut up, you little bitch! You want to join the club, you got to pass through the gauntlet. Is the ride part of the gauntlet?
There were no seat belts in the back seat of the truck, forcing Cliff to brace himself using his arms and legs. A car on the opposite side of the road flew past them, swerving to avoid a collision and laying on their horn.
The ride is the gauntlet, kid.
Scar drove with one hand on the wheel, the other hanging out the window. It was too straight-edged to drive with two hands.
If you survive this, the real fun begins.
Cliff's stomach rolled, and he looked back behind him to see if he could glimpse the towering emerald roofs of Foxwoods Casino in the distance, but all he could see were the gnarled, slumbering corpses of wintered trees and the remains of fallen stone walls that used to mean something to someone. Probably the colonial farmers who had taken their land. Willow was Scar's boyfriend. His real name wasn't Scar, it was Kevin or some shit like that, but he'd been Scar for as long as Cliff had known him. He had an inch-long scar that ran vertically down his chin, which he claimed he'd received in an underground fight club he'd attended in New London, but Cliff secretly suspected that was a lie. His other identifying mark lay on his ankle, an amateur tattoo of an eye, which he ensured was always visible by wearing pants that were too short. Scar was the leader of the Rez Cats, a gang made exclusively of those who lived on the Pequot Reservation. Willow was the only female member of the gang, an honor she'd snagged for herself as a perk of dating Scar. And now that Cliff was 17, it was his turn to step up and join the ranks. That was, if he could pass the initiation. What that was exactly, Cliff had not been told. Scar liked keeping his initiates in the dark as long as possible. Cliff had been speculating about what it could be for over a week now. His stomach growing constantly tighter as his nerves came to a climax and the date finally arrived. He curled his hands into fists and dug his nails into his skin. He hated going off the reservation. There was irony in there somewhere, as his dad had barely qualified for the reservation's heritage standards, being only 1/16th native. And there were many who claimed that the entire reservation was a fraud and no one there was even descended from the original Pequot tribe. Cliff could continue living there as long as he lived with his parents, but he couldn't buy property of his own. His mom was completely white, too, which wasn't strange for members of the reservation. Many of them married non-natives, but it put Cliff in a strange position. He didn't look native at all, except that his skin was a slightly darker shade than most of his friends at school. And yet he'd grown up as part of this tribe and felt connected to this native identity, as it was what he'd been surrounded with and labeled as his entire life. And yet he knew one day he'd have to step away from all that. Joining this gang was both a desperate attempt to cling to his native identity and also Cliff simply living up to what was expected of him. He'd been hanging out with the gang for years ever since his sister joined, so it had always been his path once he was old enough. Even though Willow treated him like shit and threatened him if he embarrassed her in front of her friends, Cliff wanted to be like her. Gravel skidded under the truck's flat tires as Scar steered his vehicle off to the side of the road and onto a small dirt turnabout. "All right, hot stuff, we walk from here." Cliff was glad to be out of the car. He wasn't a fan of Scar and he liked his driving even less. The November air was brisk as he followed Scar and Willow down a dirt path into the winding woods. Cliff zipped up his plaid jacket and kept his hands shoved into his armpits, keeping his eyes on his sister. Scar happened to glance back and grinned like the devil. "Yo, keep your eyes off my girl's ass, freak." He slid his arm around Willow's butt and squeezed. Willow elbowed him, but that only encouraged Scar to squeeze harder. "Hey, this is my ass. What are you trying to pull?" "She's my sister," Cliff muttered under his breath. But he didn't dare speak any louder. They followed the trail beneath a cloudy sky that masked the sun's descent until Cliff could distinguish a structure up ahead. As they grew closer, the details became clear. It was a house. A Queen Anne Victorian house, to be exact, painted in fading red and trimmed with white. Gutters were hanging from the sagging roof, and the lichen-eaten walls were in dire need of a good power washing, but Cliff still found himself in awe at the ramshackle grandeur of the edifice and imagined how glorious it must have been years ago. "What an eyesore," Scar scoffed. "Leave it to the crackers to build something as shitty as this. Their buildings are a wound to our land." "And what is Foxwoods?" Cliff thought. "Is that what our ancestors would have wanted?" Scar was black, and his mom claimed native heritage. His pretended pride in his native ancestry was something that irked Cliff to no end. They were approaching the house from behind, but Cliff could see a gravel driveway snaking its way through the leafless trees, with branches stretching up to the ashy sky like witches' fingers. All of a sudden, Scar and Willow dove behind a moss-covered rock wall, and Cliff followed their lead. Crouching on the damp covering of leaves, he peeked through the rocks to see an elderly woman with flowing white hair in a tan cardigan smoking a cigarette on the back steps. Cliff's heart began to pound. What if they wanted him to hurt this old lady? They were on her property now. He wanted to prove himself and join the gang, but he didn't want to end up in jail in the process. The scent of tobacco smoke wafted through the air. "Man, I could use one of those right now." Willow hunkered down against the wall, trying to stay warm. Cliff kept his eyes on the woman until she stomped out her cigarette and stepped inside through a billowing sheer curtain. "Perfect," Scar hissed. "She left the door wide open. He turned to Cliff. Here's what you gotta do, little man. Sneak inside and take something from that house. It's gotta be valuable. Something we can sell. You gotta choose wisely, because if you pick something that ain't worth shit, it don't count. Cliff looked to Willow, whose eyes actually expressed a gleam of sympathy. That's it? He asked. Just take something and I'm in? That's it, Scar confirmed. Easy peasy, right? Cliff took a deep breath. He had no weapons on him. That was part of the deal. If they got nabbed for trespassing, he didn't want to add being armed to the charges anyway. Don't piss your pants, Squirt. We're coming in, too. Willow gave Cliff a dead arm. Really? You don't think we'd let you go in on your own, do you? We gotta protect our investment. Plus, there might be more shit we can steal. First thing you gotta learn about the Rez Cats is we stick together. That being said, first sign of danger, we outta here. You fall behind, you're on your own, cuz. Scar clapped Cliff on the back, then hopped over the wall. Willow crept after Scar and Cliff followed behind them. He kept his eyes on the ground, doing his best to avoid crunching leaves. Scar peeked in through the open back door, curtain billowing in the crisp breeze, then beckoned for them to follow as he slipped inside. Cliff scraped his boots on the stone steps, took a deep breath, and forced himself to step into the void. At first, Cliff couldn't see anything. Heavy curtains were pulled over all the windows, and no lights were turned on in the house, filling his view with a stagnant gloom, causing his eyes to play tricks on him. There were several moments when he thought he saw inhuman faces peering at him from the darkness. Then gradually, his vision began to adjust, and he noticed that he was in a cramped hallway with intricate wood trimming and a crimson-red patterned wallpaper. Willow glanced over her shoulder at Cliff, noticing the force with which he was clenching his jaw. You good, Holmes? Yeah, Cliff managed to mutter. It just feels wrong, you know? It's not wrong, Scar hissed. This land belongs to us. So does everything on it. Scar stopped, then rotated on his heels, facing Willow and Cliff. I'm gonna go ahead, scope the place out. You two check these rooms on the right. He motioned to a couple of doorways that they had walked past, but Cliff had completely missed, caught up in his own thoughts. Then Scar vanished into another room. You and me, chump, Willow whispered, not trying at all to hide her disdain at her predicament of being stuck with Cliff. Check that table. Before Cliff could protest, Willow was moving into one of the rooms. Cliff turned and spotted a small table against the wall of the hallway. Atop it sat an old lamp and several unopened letters. There was one small drawer in the table, and Cliff checked there first. The drawer was empty, except for a 6-inch-long sword. In reality, it was a letter opener, but Cliff just assumed it was a toy or replica and shoved it into his pocket. As he did, he felt the tip and winced as a single drop of blood ran down his finger. He sucked on his finger while he rummaged through the pile of mail. There were bills, magazines, and other pages, all addressed to Morgan or Katrina Vanderburg. Not finding anything particularly interesting, Cliff moved on, stopping to examine a series of framed photographs hung on the wall. There were two young blonde girls, one lithe and thin, the other curvy, with wide hips. They had their arms around each other, and as Cliff ran his eyes across the photos, he could almost see them aging. It was like watching a lifetime play out before him. Thump. Cliff nearly jumped out of his skin. He scurried after Willow, passing through a sitting room, and found himself in another hall. This place was a lot bigger inside than it looked. There was an alcove directly in front of him, not quite a room, as there was no door, but large enough that it had its own ceiling and a few feet of space to maneuver. Cliff was drawn to the alcove by the overhead light that shone down on the space's central display. A petrified mummy, resting upright in a stone sarcophagus sealed behind a glass case.
Whoa!
Cliff had never seen a real mummy before. The corpse was massive. Even in death, it towered over Cliff. He could only imagine how large the figure must have been in life. He found himself studying the creature's face, unable to look away. The shriveled features and sunken eyes, the jaw warped eternally open as if in a scream of agony. Poking out from a small tear in the cloth was what Cliff could only assume was a human tooth, a glimpse behind the veil of this horrific monstrosity. He shivered involuntarily and remembered that he still had to find Willow. He had to find some kind of object and ditch this house of horrors. What kind of freak would want something like that displayed in their home? Cliff followed the hall and stopped abruptly when a staircase opened on his right, leading up to the second story. Listening closely, Cliff heard muttering voices, and thinking that it might be Willow and Scar, he ascended, stepping lightly to mask his presence. The voices were coming from a door that was cracked open along the upper hall. Cliff loitered outside the door, straining to catch what was being said. "This life is beginning to wear on me, sister. I must confess that I do not believe we will see their return in the flesh." "It was promised, my dear. The great old ones do not go back on their promises. They will reward us for our service. I want that day to come, and I want you by my side when it does. Always, my love, we are one." Cliff peered through the crack and saw the old woman from before kneeling in front of another gray-haired woman in her rocking chair. He watched as their lips met in a sensuous embrace, before the kneeling woman's eyes flickered to the doorway and met his own. Cliff instinctively pulled away and pressed his back flat to the wall, but it was too little, too late. There was a shrill cry from the room, and Cliff scrambled, hunting for a way out. He tore open a door around the corner and pulled it mostly closed. He was in some kind of stuffy closet. Something warm and itchy pressed itself against the back of his neck, and he found it hard to breathe. But Cliff stood still as a statue, praying that he wouldn't be discovered. This was not what he had signed up for.
"Scree! Scree! Shub-Niggurath! An intruder! Quickly, we must perform the ritual! No, there must be another way! There is no other way, sister! Give me your hand!"
There was a sharp cry, followed by chanting in a language that Cliff did not understand. He heard shuffling, a door open and close, and then footsteps descending the stairs. Instead of coming after him, they were leaving. This was his lucky break. Cliff slid out of the closet and poked his head back into the room where the sisters had been. There was a dagger lying on the chair, tip painted with blood, and on the floor were strange runes and symbols which appeared to have been hastily scrawled in the same substance. The scene before him began to vanish before his eyes as a thick cloud of mist seemed to enter the room. At first, Cliff assumed it must be smoke from a fire, but the cloud did not smell like smoke. Rather, it had a musty and moist odor, as if he were standing in a swamp. Within seconds, his visibility shrank to only a foot or two in front of him.
What was this witchery?
Cliff felt his way blindly for the stairs and descended. He heard his name being called and followed the sound, turning corners and entering rooms until he found Willow. She took his hands and pulled him into an adjacent room, then shut the door. The fog was not so thick here, and there appeared to be only one entrance.
"I saw someone. Two old hags upstairs, they were talking in another language."
Willow's eyes momentarily displayed her concern, but she wiped it away as she waved the smoke from her face and motioned around the room.
"Whatever, just grab something and we'll bail, look."
Cliff took in his surroundings for the first time and saw that they were in some kind of occult museum. The room was large, at least 40 feet across and 30 wide. There were shelves and glass display cases hosting all kinds of curiosities and strange items. Bookcases overflowing with ancient tomes written in forgotten languages and paintings hanging on the wall depicting carnivorous dog creatures and macabre monstrosities too horrible to describe. Cliff passed through the room, a stranger in a strange land, observing each mist-shrouded commodity with curiosity and a glimmer of fear. The billowing cloud gave this space an otherworldly atmosphere, and Cliff felt as if he were walking through a dream. He scanned the titles of several leather-bound books displayed under a glass case, reading the names to himself as his eyes scanned the words. The Necronomicon, Lex Tenebrarum, the Book of Ibon. Some of the books looked like they might be worth something, but he wasn't sure. He passed by a statue of a faceless figure in a dark robe, tentacles protruding from the bottom where its feet should be, and he realized he was getting a headache. Was it the mist or the stress? Maybe both. Cliff arrived at an open shelf with several shimmering objects and decided to grab something. This was as good as it was going to get. He tried to appraise the things in his mind, but had no idea what a black trapezohedron, a brain in a cylinder, or a tarnished silver key would be worth. But what he ended up selecting was a palm-sized gold jewel carved intricately into the shape of an eye. He'd taken the eye because he knew the value of gold, but after looking at it, he saw that it was in fact quite beautiful. The eye was simple enough, a pupil and iris gazing forever outwards, causing Cliff to grow increasingly uncomfortable until he turned the thing over. There was no eyelid, but around the eye and on the backside were complex and labyrinthine carvings, symbols and hieroglyphics interwoven with decorative flourishes and pictures of nameless beasts. The eye was mesmerizing, and when he looked again into its lidless face, Cliff also felt as if it were gazing back into him. He shuddered, suddenly feeling vulnerable and violated. His trance was broken by the shattering of glass. Cliff pocketed the eye and rushed out the door to find shards of jagged glass scattered across the carpeted floor. His eyes followed the trail to its inevitable end. An empty sarcophagus. Cliff turned to warn Willow, but there was already a hand extending toward her out of the fog. Cliff screamed. As Scar's hand clamped down on her shoulder, even Willow jumped.
Gee, Scar, you scared the shit out of me.
What the hell's going on here? Did the old lady turn on a fog machine or something? He smacked Cliff's shoulder with the back of his hand without waiting for an answer. Did you get it?
Yeah.
Good, let's get the hell out of here. Scar shoved Cliff aside, pushing past him down the hall. There was something else. Another sound that Cliff's mind had registered, but hadn't paid any notice to yet. Footsteps, shuffling over carpet. Scar had hardly taken two steps when bandaged hands found his throat and shoved him hard back against the wall. Scar fought to break free, but the thing's hands were too powerful. Finally, Scar managed to bring his leg up and kick the thing away from him, but it was only a momentary victory. The dark, looming shape wrenched Scar back as he attempted to flee, and in one quick, violent motion snapped Scar's neck. Scar's limp body drooped and sunk to the floor. Willow's mouth hung agape, too terrified to scream. The shape stepped closer through the fog, continuing its morbid mission, and revealed itself to Cliff in its full and unholy form, though he already knew what it was. A walking mummy. Cliff shoved Willow, forcing her feet to move, and then allowed her to take his hand and pull him behind her as she fled down the hallway through a series of mist-shrouded rooms toward the back of the house. All the while Cliff listened, his ears grasping the shuffling of feet that still pursued them, though their attacker was no longer visible. Willow burst into the back room and flung herself at the door, only to be met with a resounding crash of a clattering metal gate that was blocking their escape. It was a security gate, not uncommon to have in one's house, but Cliff and the others had completely failed to notice it on their way in. Willow shook the gate violently, creating a loud ruckus, but the gate was locked tight. With that option unavailable, Cliff turned to the windows, only to find that they, too, were blocked with security gates. Unbelievable! Willow found Cliff in the dismal fog and took him by the shoulders. He looked into her eyes for the first time in months and saw real emotion. Fear.
What is that thing?
A mummy, Cliff muttered. I saw it earlier.
You saw it walking around and you didn't say anything?
No, it wasn't walking around. It was dead.
Yeah, well, clearly it wasn't dead.
Cliff shoved her away. Don't blame this on me. I'm not the one who chose the house with the reanimated mummy for my initiation. Nice one. Willow wiped a tear from her cheek as she straightened her bandana. Screw you. Scar is... He's... Cliff felt a rush of empathy as he remembered the tragic events which had happened only moments ago. He's gone. He took a step toward his sister. And we will be too if we don't get out of here. Come on. There's got to be another way. As Cliff took Willow's hand, a malicious cackle rang through the house. From somewhere in the corpse-haunted estate, a door slammed. And there was another sound. The shuffling. The creature had finally caught up with them. Emerging through the primordial mist like a being from another dimension, the mummy, arms stretched outward, descended upon Cliff and Willow. With all their exits blocked, Willow picked up a wicker chair and held the legs out at the creature. The mummy took hold of the legs, managing to rip the chair from Willow's grasp, but not before she used her momentum to spin around the mummy so that she and Cliff, who clung to her like a shadow, were now facing the entrance to the hallway. The mummy hurled the chair against the wall, but Willow and Cliff were already running blindly through the ever-thickening clouds. "We're never going to find a way out of here," Cliff wailed, hanging onto Willow's jean jacket. "Shut up! In here! Let's go!" Willow shoved Cliff into a room and shut the door behind them. She fumbled with the doorknob and cheered under her breath as she found that the door actually locked. They had managed to buy themselves some time, but they were also trapped, as Cliff realized by looking around at the small dining room. It was a dead end. There was a single window against the opposite wall, which, surprise, surprise, was covered by a metal cage. Cliff cut through the mist and inspected the cage more closely, looking for a weakness. Instead, he found that the corners were bolted deep into the wall. Without the proper tools, there would be no opening the cage. He slammed his fists against the cage in frustration, sending it rattling, and slumped down against the wall. Willow joined him, and for a moment they sat in silence, two siblings lost in their own existential thoughts as they awaited their inevitable doom. Finally, Willow broke the silence. "How long do you think we have before it finds us?" Cliff snorted. "Minutes, maybe?" Willow stared off into space, clutching her legs to her chest and rocking slowly back and forth. "I'm sorry that Scar and I treated you like an ass. I guess I haven't been very cool to you." Cliff had never heard his sister apologize to him before, not since they were little kids and their mom made them. This was sincere. "It's whatever," he said, trying to play it off. "Thanks for trying to get me into the Rescats." Willow chuckled. "You shouldn't be thanking me for that. They're a joke." "Yeah, well, you were in it. I just wanted to be like you. You shouldn't always do everything I do. You're better off doing your own thing, for real. And now that Scar's gone, I guess I'm out too." Cliff wasn't sure what to say for a moment. He'd imagined them together, chilling with the gang for months. "Killed by a mummy. Not how I thought I'd go out." Willow laughed. It reminded Cliff of how she used to laugh when they were kids. "Right? Like, what the hell?" The door thumped as something slammed on it from the other side. Slowly, Willow and Cliff rose in unison. She looked at Cliff and he looked at her, and he knew they were thinking the same damn thing. "You ready?" The slamming on the door grew more impetuous and frequent, and Cliff guessed they only had a few moments left. "Yeah, Rescats ain't going down without a fight. Hoo-ah!" Willow raised her fists, sinking into a fighter's stance as the door burst open. What happened next was a blur. Cliff and Willow both charged at the mummy, but all Cliff remembered was feeling strong hands hoist him by the shirt and fling him against the wall. He blacked out for a moment, and when he opened his eyes, he saw through blurred vision Willow being dragged off by the monster, whose massive arm held her tightly against its torso. He saw her legs kick wildly, her fingers grasp for the doorframe and then tear free. Cliff heard his name being called in high-pitched squeals as his panicked sister was ripped away from him. Cliff struggled to his feet and immediately fell down, too dizzy to stand, his head throbbing where it had struck the wall. He could feel a bump forming and absently wondered if he had a concussion. He waited a moment for his head to calm, until he could wait no longer, and with his head still spinning, climbed carefully to his feet. He went slower this time. With one hand against the wall for balance, he edged into the hall, sliding through the mist, not knowing his destination. There were no more screams, no footprints or signs to follow. He was lost in a maze that had no escape. After a few minutes of aimless searching, Cliff began to call Willow's name. There was no response. The witch sisters were gone too. He was all alone. Cliff sat on the floor, the fog crowding in around him, suffocating him like an airless tomb. With no other recourse, he pulled out the golden eye and held it in his hand. There was no point in keeping it. It couldn't help him escape. It couldn't help him join the Rezcats, and it couldn't help him find his sister. All of this, his entire predicament, he blamed on the eye. He was about to cast it into the fog when he noticed that on one end there was a tiny clasp, a hinge, that allowed the eye to open lengthwise. Cliff carefully played with the eye until he managed to slide one half open, revealing a glowing stone hidden inside the eye. The glow lit up the whole hallway and seemed to dispel the mists of darkness. As he reached his finger out to touch the ancient form of illumination, his soul was rekindled with a feeling of hope that perhaps things might be okay after all. The stone was warm to the touch, and he resolved that he was going to keep searching. This must be some kind of sign. Don't give up on her. Don't give up on you. Raised voices and mechanical slamming reached his ears, and Cliff took the stone and used it to guide himself toward the sounds. They led him to a sealed gate, but on the other side he saw a set of stairs descending into some kind of basement. He sensed intrinsically that Willow was down there, and that was where he had to go. The gate was locked. Cliff had been here before, but with no other option and his sister on the line, Cliff backed up against the wall and flung himself against the metal gate. The gate rattled, but did not give way. Undeterred, Cliff tried again, throwing his body as hard as he could against the gate until miraculously the gate itself broke and Cliff's body fell through it, tumbling down the stairs to the cold stone floor. There was no longer any hope of surprising whoever was down there, as his fall no doubt alerted them of his arrival. Before he could even stand up, bandaged hands grabbed Cliff and restrained his arms, then proceeded to drag him down a dark subterranean passage. The stone had fallen from his hand, and he watched as the light diminished the further they traveled. The tunnel was made of rock, that much he could tell. The ceiling was arched, and water dripped on him occasionally, and he could feel his shoes passing over cobbled stones. Whatever this place was, it was old. At last, Cliff saw light beginning to illuminate the passage again, and he was pulled into a larger room with torches on sconces lighting the ancient chamber. He had found Willow, but he was too late. As the Vanderberg sisters were in the process of wrapping her in burial rags, her body splayed out on an altar. Willow's eyes found Cliff's, pleading silently for assistance which he could not give. He jerked as hard as he could, but the mummy held him firm. If he didn't do something soon, these hags would soon have another mummy for their collection. As they worked, they chanted in a forgotten language, filling his soul with dread. It was then, in his moment of utmost despair, that Cliff remembered the letter opener he had stashed in his pocket. His arms were pinned, but his right hand could almost reach his pocket, where he could feel the sharp prick of the sword jabbing into his thigh. He repositioned himself and gripped the sword. He spun the blade deftly in his fingers and stabbed it into the mummy's hand. He wasn't sure if it caused the thing pain or not, but it was enough of a shock that it caused the mummy to let go of him for a moment, and that moment was all he needed. He burst free of his captor's grasp, spun, and rammed the letter opener into the mummy's eye socket. It flailed, blindly attempting to pull the thing from its face with bandaged hands. Cliff tore one of the torches off the wall and held it out in front of him, thrusting it at the mummy who was lumbering toward him, its ancient wrappings instantly going up in flame, turning it into an undead pyre. Cliff swung the torch at the sisters, but they did not flinch. He moved around the burning mummy to his sister's side, who was using his diversion to pull her legs out of the wrapped cloth. There was a shift in the language spoken by the old women, and Cliff sensed that they had begun to evoke a new evil. Slowly, as if by some unseen sorcery, Cliff's torch began to die. He had time to give Willow a look of utter and desperate terror before they were plunged into infinite darkness. The darkness of the pit, where no light could enter. They were deep underground, trapped with two dangerous witches capable of unknowable magic, and now they were blind. What could they possibly do? Cliff and Willow found each other in the darkness and held each other tight. Their world was a blur of sensory experiences of which Cliff had never before partaken and never would again. Strange sounds that were unlike anything earthly rose to his ears. He felt something slimy run past his arm in the dark. Something was there in the room with him, but there was no way of knowing what it was. Light erupted into being, filling the room with a whirlpool of colors that Cliff did not know existed. The sisters were gone, as was the mummy, but in their place was something even more horrifying, something that caused his sister to scream. As Cliff looked at her, he saw only a reflection in her eye, the outline of an impossible shape that floated in the room several feet above the floor. Her eyes were wide with terror and awe, her mouth hanging open, unable to look away. Her entire body was quivering from the powerful experience, and Cliff had to physically pull her off the altar and force her to look at him, at which point she seemed to return to herself, and together they ran up a set of stairs on the far side of the room. The phantasmagorical colors still swirling around them, and arrived at a metal bulkhead door, which they threw open, permitting them to exit into the fresh air and free world. The bulkhead door was in the middle of the woods, but eventually, after stumbling through the dark and cutting themselves on prickers, they found the Vanderburg house again and were able to make it back to the road. As they hobbled back toward the reservation, Willow at one point stopped, and the look of terror returned to her face as she gazed upon the road ahead of them.
"What's wrong?" Cliff asked. "You don't see it?" "See what?" "The eye."
Willow's gaze was fixed before them at the empty road. Cliff saw nothing.
"It followed us from that place."
She sank into an inconsolable babbling, and Cliff guided her around the invisible obstruction, forcing her to continue their trek until she calmed down, and at last they arrived at home. They were done with the gang after that. Willow began going to therapy, but every so often he would find her staring off into the distance, at nothing in particular. On multiple occasions, he stumbled upon her late at night, scribbling in a notebook and muttering to herself. At one point, curiosity got the better of him, and he snuck into her room while she was out and opened one of the notebooks. It was the same line, written over and over again. "We are always being watched." Eventually, Willow left the reservation, and Cliff stayed to care for their ailing dad. He didn't hear from her much after that, though on the rare occasions when he did, she was kind to him. That night in the manor had repaired their relationship in a way that Cliff had never hoped for. Unfortunately, it had also broken Willow in a way he could have never imagined. Whatever she had seen, or thought she had seen, was haunting her. That much was clear. What little Cliff did know of his sister's whereabouts was mostly from postcards or late-night phone calls that didn't last long. He knew she was traveling around, and he always encouraged her to come home.
"I can't," she would always say.
"Why not?"
"You know why."
Sometimes she would call him in the middle of a panic attack, and he would have to talk her down. He was the only one who could, the only one who would understand, even if he didn't truly understand. Despite Willow's sporadic drifting and frequent panic attacks, Cliff had always remained optimistic about her future. He often thought about the light he had seen, and guessed that maybe the light had changed him, given him a glimpse of something pure and peaceful, something that might one day be, but was not yet. Willow was out of the gang. She was out on her own, financially independent, and he hoped that one day she would settle down, and maybe therapy or medication would be able to help her mental state. Which is why he was shocked when one morning he received a phone call informing him Willow was dead. Cliff flew out to Arizona later that day, where he met with local police and identified her body at the hospital morgue. According to the report, she had been discovered by a maid, murdered in her hotel room. The police had no leads, other than their guess that the suspect was male. Willow had been strangled to death, and her neck bore deep bruises, the size of which suggested the killer had large hands. Only two other items were found in the room. One of them was a small piece of old linen cloth of questionable origin, perhaps torn from the attacker, though after observation, it was determined the cloth would not help them solve the murder. The other item that was presented to Cliff was an envelope addressed to him. The police assured him they had not opened it, but were eager for him to do so, as they hoped that it might give them a clue as to what had occurred. They left Cliff alone in a room at the police station with the letter. It was all that he had left of his sister, and Cliff took his time to open it, only to scoff at its contents, while at the same time, an icy claw of terror wormed its way into his heart. The envelope contained a single sheet of paper, and as Cliff unfolded it, saw that it bore no words, but only a single familiar image. It was the same image he thought he had seen reflected in Willow's pupils that night at Vanderburg Manor, but which he had convinced himself had been a trick of the light. It was the singular illustration, drawn by Willow's own hand, of a horrific, levitating eye.
What'd you think of it?
This was a doozy.
A doozy, yes.
Is this the longest original piece we've ever had on the podcast?
It definitely is up there. I think absolutely it might be. It's like almost 40 minutes long narrated.
Indeed.
Yeah.
I mean, I just love this story.
Yes.
It has so many layers, so many like little multi-dimensional characters in there.
Totally.
And you get some really just fun moments.
And it takes place, Derek and I realized when he submitted this, that we grew up very, very close to each other in southeastern Connecticut. And so there's a lot of mention of Foxwoods Casino and the reservations there, which we both grew up very close to. So that was really fun for me to, you know, to kind of see that nod to my childhood in that way. But in general, yes, the story is, it really is like this epic journey, you know, and also how this ritual impacts them at the end of the day, and it's kind of sad and it's tragic, and there's so many layers to it. Like you said, there's kind of this sibling relationship that's mended but also never has the chance to really blossom into something. And so beyond being a horror story and kind of like this action tale, it also has, you know, some intense interpersonal relationships as well.
Okay, so geez, where to start? I feel like we're like giving a book review. It was so long.
I know. Yeah.
I mean, just like, no spoilers.
Well, no spoilers. You just listened to it. But no spoilers.
I did appreciate that the mummy was scary.
It was scary.
You know, and yeah. It's, I feel like that's hard to do. It's because he used more of the traditional lumbering mummy.
Right.
But he did a good job in making him scary.
Oh, yeah. Especially with sort of the like tense moments of, they're hiding and they hear the thump of it come, you know, it definitely sent shivers down my spine.
It's a tough thing to do. I mean, we've applauded Derek's writing a million times. We'll just do it one more. it's great. This is a fun story.
Yeah.
And Derek aside,
yes.
We had some real treats from Bob in this one.
Oh, yes. as we
first
love.
Was right almost right off the bat, where you get to hear Bob Dawn of Bob's Short Story Hour say the phrase "Shut up, you little bitch."
I know. I actually really, I remember when I was editing it, I was just like, "Oh hell yeah!"
it's just that's something that I didn't know that I needed to hear until I did. And, you know, that's just a check off the bucket list.
Sure, yeah.
So that was a lot of fun. And then furthermore, Bob settled a long time debate that I've had many, many times with people.
Okay.
Apparently, I've been having the incorrect debate the entire time.
Sounds right.
So I was never sure whether you're describing something is like a labyrinth.
Okay.
Is it labyrinthian or labyrinthine?
This is a debate that you have often with people?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. I can't explain it. It just somehow keeps coming up on set.
Okay.
And however, apparently it's neither of those. It is apparently labyrinthine.
Well, that would be a Derek. A Derek settled that for you because he wrote it.
Well, it's more of just like, how is it pronounced?
Oh, I see.
I mean, my eyes have always just glanced over the word.
Mm-hmm.
It went on the few occasions that it's been read, but normally it just comes up in, you know, everyday conversation.
Bob is great for learning how to pronounce things.
He is. so that was a fun little fact for the day.
Yeah, good to know. Next time I'm describing something that is like a labyrinth, I will know that it is
labyrinthine.
Labyrinthian.
No, it's labyrinthine.
Labyrinthine.
Yes.
Okay.
Not labyrinthy.
Labyrinthine.
Right. But I always love labyrinthine.
Labyrinthine.
But that's just not a word, apparently.
It could be the name of a band.
Sure. Anything could be the name of a band.
It's very true. Well, thank you guys so much for listening. It's so good to be back. Recording feels so good. And I'm just so thrilled that we finally got to do the Mummy series. It has been in the works for so long. And if you missed the first two parts, go back and listen to the history of mummification and sort of the, you know, our exploration of mummies in pop culture and how they've become a horror staple, if you will. But so honored to round it out with the help of Tessa and Bob and, of course, Derek. So please support all of them. And we are back next week with something really fun, a little pause in our Universal Monster exploration, but we will be back again to that the week after. Stay safe, stay spooky, and we'll talk to you very soon.
Bye.
Bye. Thanks for listening. If you'd like some bonus content, consider supporting us on Patreon to access our patron-exclusive podcast, Horror Movie Club.
Also, head to lunaticsproject.com to check out our spooky merch and apparel.
You can find us at Lunatics Project on Twitter and TikTok, and The Lunatics Project on Instagram and YouTube, where you'll find our short horror films, cemetery tours, and so much more.
And please rate and review. A little feedback goes a long way to help us grow and get more content out there.
Our cover art is by Pilar Kep, and musical bumpers are by Michaela Papa and Jordan Moser.